The Peddler's Boy, or I'll Be Somebody. The Peddler's Boy. Chap. I. A Bird's Eye Glance. Among the many beautiful villages near Boston, there is one quite as beautiful as any, situated but a few miles from that busy metropolis, called, but I must not mention its name, that is of very little consequence. A few rods from the common, the pride of the Bostonians, is the depot of the railroad which passes through this place, and one has only to jump into the cars, and in less than 15 minutes he is there. Uncle Frank has some dear friends in this village, and choice spirits they are, in his estimation. How much this fact has to do with his opinion of the beauty of the place, he does not pretend to say. He has scarcely settled it in his own mind. Nor is it much matter, as the story about to be related will neither lose nor gain much in its interest, by the good or ill opinion which the reader may happen to have of the village itself, though I may be pardoned for adding that I should put rather a low value upon the taste of that man, or woman, or child, who could visit this part of the country, when nature has her best dress on, and not pronounce it one of the most delightful spots, in his or her opinion, that the sun or moon ever shone upon. Among my friends in this charming village, is one whom, at present, I will call Mr. Bissell, Mr. Samuel Bissell. I will call him so for the present, I say. His real name is no more like Bissell than yours is, no more like Samuel Bissell than it is like John Smith or George Jones, but I think he will forgive us, though, for taking such a liberty with his good name, should he ever happen to come across this story, and should it prove to him a sort of looking-glass, in which he can see his own features. When he was a lad, about 12 years old, his father, who had been possessed of a handsome property, failed in business, and as Samuel says, became as poor as a church mouse. What would have taken place if Samuel's father had been successful in his business affairs, so that it would not have been absolutely necessary for the lad to work for a living, is more than I can say. Probably it is more than anybody can say. Very likely it would not have been as well for Samuel. It is a good thing for boys and girls to work. Idleness is the cause of a great deal of mischief. I really pity the boy whose father brings him up without giving him a chance to learn some trade or profession. I'm always afraid that, in such cases, the lad will learn a trade on his own hook, and one which will give him trouble, if his father or guardian does not himself see that he gets something better to do. As I was saying, it is impossible to tell what would have been the history of Samuel Bissell, if, by his father's failure in business, he had not been driven to get a living by his own labor. It is enough for us to know what his history actually was in the circumstances in which he was placed when his father, by a sudden change of fortune, became a poor man. But I must go back a little in my history. I want you to see and mark well two or three things, which, though little in themselves, are very important. Little things, let me tell you, are not to be despised, because they are little. A very small stream of water, which you might easily wade across, can set the machinery of a whole factory in motion. Half a dozen marks made with a pen in as many seconds, are sufficient to send weeping and death into every family in an empire. So I must go back a few years in the history of our young friend, and see where he was, what he was, and what sort of a bringing up he had, before the time of his father's unfortunate failure. Chap. 2. Peddlers and Peddling. I have more than half a mind to give you a rough sketch of the Yankee peddler. But I know all about this race of men already, perhaps you will say. Do you? Well, then, consider my sketches having been made for another reader, and not for you. The fact is, for I want to let you into one of my little secrets, just here, to start with, the story I am telling is one about a peddler's boy, and I have got a notion that it would be a good plan to devote one chapter, before I have any more to do with the boy himself, to that famous class of men who get their living principally by peddling small wares about the country. The peddler, the genuine Massachusetts or Connecticut peddler, usually has a wagon built on purpose for his business, so fitted up that it will conveniently hold all the articles he has for sale. One who has ever taken a peep into a peddler's wagon, will not need to be told that his assortment comprises a great many different articles. Tinware occupies a large space. In this department may be found tin ovens, saucepans, milk pans, graters, skimmers, and things of that sort. Then the genuine peddler is always provided with two tin trunks, I believe, trunks which are large enough to hold about half a bushel each. These trunks are stored full of little knick-knacks, too numerous to mention, as the dealer in dry goods has said in his advertisement. The peddler does not often drive his trade in the city. He finds the country the best place for him. So you generally come across him where there are not many stores, and where the houses are not very close together. He stops before the door of a house. I say he stops, but I ought rather to have set his horse, for the old nag, who, perhaps, has been in his service for a quarter of a century, stops of her own accord at the door of every respectable-looking house on the route. She needs no hint from her master in relation to this matter. Indeed, I once heard of a peddler's mare, who was so well persuaded that it would be for the interest of her master to stop at the gate of a certain large and neat-looking farmhouse, which gate the peddler seemed, for once, disposed to pass by, that she actually stopped in the road, and looked round at the man who had the helm, as if she would say, "My dear sir, there must be some mistake about this matter. Are you crazy? Upon my word, this is one of the strangest things that has ever turned up since we've been driving this peddling business." We will suppose, now, that the faithful horse, guided by something which, for want of a better name, people generally call instinct, but which seems to me a good deal like reason, has stopped at the door of the house. The peddler, taking good care to carry along with him the tin trunks before mentioned, leaves the wagon, and goes into the house, the faithful mare, in the meantime, leisurely grazing, if it is summer, and stamping and kicking, just for exercise, in order to keep warm, if it is winter. "Any tinware today, madam?" the peddler asks. Perhaps madam does want some tinware, and perhaps she does not. We will suppose, now, that as far as the department of tinware is concerned, her wants have been entirely supplied. Then follows a partial enumeration of the contents of the two trunks. Did you ever hear a peddler rattle over the names of these small wares? He does it as rapidly, almost, as a bobolink goes through the different notes of his song: any pins, needles, sewing silk, twist, buttons, tape, jew's harps, hooks and eyes, scissors, penknives, pocketbooks, handkerchiefs, breast pins, earrings, and so he runs on, hardly waiting for the good lady, who is looking over the articles by this time, to put in a word edgewise. Peddlers, as a class, are set down as pretty wide awake and driving a bargain. They have been slandered, I doubt not. A great deal of unfairness and dishonesty have been charged to them, of which they never were guilty. Still, I think they are apt to be pretty shrewd and keen, when they are trading. Sometimes, no doubt, though not always, they are too shrewd and keen to be strictly honest, for there is a point where shrewdness and keenness ought to stop. When I was a little boy, I lived in Connecticut. My home was in the very bosom of the country. It was not often that anybody from the busy world came there, and when one did come, he was sure to make something of a stir, especially among us little folks. The advent of a tin peddler's wagon, I recollect, I hailed as a most remarkable event. It always seemed to me that a peddler's head was as full of knowledge as it could well hold. Such a budget of news as he always opened. Such smart things as those which came from his mouth. Such wonderful good nature as he showed towards the children. Why, I don't remember that I ever heard a peddler speak cross to a boy, though we used always to tumble over the nameless notions in his trunks to our heart's content, all the time he stayed in the house. I hardly know which interested me more, the driving up to our door of a peddler's wagon, or the entrance into our kitchen of half a dozen Mohegan Indians, with their squaws and papooses. The age of clock peddlers had not come then. Wooden clocks are plenty as blackberries now, and you can buy one for a song, almost. But Connecticut clocks were quite unknown in my childhood. Now, I suppose, the peddlers sell more clocks than tin ovens and saucepans. But the peddler of clocks and the peddler of tinware is, in all important particulars, one and the same. Did you ever hear of the peddler who sold a load of clocks that would only keep in order 24 hours, and hardly that? It seems that his clocks were, like Peter Pinder's razors, made to sell, and not to run. Well, he went a good way off from home, before he offered any of his wares for sale. He found no trouble in selling the clocks, for they were wonderfully cheap, and besides, as he took good care to inform all his customers, each clock was warranted, and on his way homeward he would call at every house where he sold a clock, when he should take pleasure in exchanging all the clocks that did not perform well. Now it turned out that his clocks were not worth a farthing. He sold out the whole load, though, every clock but one. Then he turned about, and commenced his journey homeward, calling upon all his customers, as he had agreed to do. "Well, how did that our clock run, neighbor?" "Run? It didn't run at all. It stopped as still as a gatepost before you had got up Pudding Hill."
"Did it though, really?"
"To be sure it did. What on earth did you sell me such a clock for?" "Well, now, you needn't take on in that style. I'll give you another clock. I told you I would, when I sold it to you." So the cunning peddler gives his customer the only clock he has left, and takes the one he sold him at first, in place of it.
And that is the way the fellow managed all the way home. There are a great many stories told about peddlers, which, I presume, are not true, and it is sometimes rather difficult to sift the genuine stuff from the chaff. I really don't know how much to believe of the anecdotes of Connecticut peddlers of former times. It is a matter of history that they sold wooden nutmegs, and horngun flints, and whitewood cucumber seeds, and white oak hams. But I should not wonder if these stories were made out of whole cloth. The truth is, there have been, first and last, a great many false charges made against the land of steady habits. It is a common notion that peddlers are very apt to make dupes of the ladies. Perhaps they are.